Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The 2015 legislative session came to a close late Saturday night. It was a session where money concerns seemed to dominate the debate surrounding many issues. And the session got off to an unusual start when a group of Vermonters came to the State House to protest Governor Peter Shumlin's decision not to pursue a single-payer health care system. Those protests took place on the day of Shumlin's inaugural address. Many people thought the protests led to the dismissal of Sergeant-at-Arms Francis Brooks. What kind of session was it? Today on Vermont Edition, we've got a group of the state's best political reporters to discuss the people and issues of the session. With us, Mark Johnson, host of The Mark Johnson Show, heard weekday mornings on WDEV. Terry Hallenbeck, who covers politics for 7 days, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Great to have you all with us today. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
So before we discuss the specific issues and people of the session, I'd like to get each of you to tell me your general impression of the session. I've heard a lot of different words used by lawmakers, lobbyists, and other reporters. So how would you describe the 2015 session? Terry, what do you think?
Well, I think for legislators, this was not a very fun session. This was meatloaf, and I say that as someone who doesn't really like meatloaf. Like, you know, they didn't get to do any of the social issues that the Democratic majority has enjoyed sort of doing in the past, like same-sex marriage or GMO labeling, or they didn't even get to raise the minimum wage this year in a significant way. So, you know, it was just all about cutting and taxes and things that can only get them in trouble. So I think those issues ended up being real caretaker type of stuff, none of the sexy stuff.
Mark, what do you think?
I would say unusual and bizarre would be how I would describe it. And frankly, I think this will be a legislative session that we all remember 10, 15, 20 years from now, everything from the Scott Milne Shumlin election right at the beginning. You mentioned the Sergeant-at-Arms. And, of course, you know, the arrest of Senator McAllister at the end of the session. I mean, it's I think it's really one for the memory books. And you know, I think the other real takeaway that I got from this is how the public was really looking for lawmakers to really roll back their spending. And I'm just hearing that didn't happen.
Pete?
I was struck by how incredibly fluid everything seemed to be. In years past, you get this sense that there's a small handful of people running the show and that most of the power over what happens in the building is confined to the speaker and the Senate president and the governor and a few people around them. And of course, you know, conventional power brokers still have a ton of sway. But on all kinds of issues, I didn't get the sense that those power brokers really had control over the trajectory of these issues, and that even they didn't know where things were going to land when it came to things like revenues, how much to raise, the philosophical exemption, paid sick days. So it was really anybody's game for much of the session, and you saw a lot of people make moves that some cases worked out and others didn't.
Well, the signature issue in the governor's inaugural address was a plan to raise $90 million by imposing a 0.7% payroll tax to help pay for a major health care initiative. And that state money would be matched with over $100 million in federal funds. The governor proposed using the money to boost Medicaid reimbursement rates in an effort to reduce the so-called cost shift, to pay for the state's expansion of Medicaid, and to increase the budgets of the Green Mountain Care Board and the Blueprint for Health. Here's the governor at the beginning of the session.
Current Medicaid reimbursements drive up private insurance costs for businesses and individuals, acting as a hidden tax cost shift. This amounts to an astounding $150 million in private premium inflation in Vermont every single year.
But the plan ran into a lot of problems at the State House, and the head of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay, said he couldn't guarantee that money put into the cost shift would actually lower private health insurance premiums.
Can the board guarantee this? And again, I will say no. you know, that if that's the way, the only reason they would do this, then they shouldn't do it. I mean, you cannot, in such a complicated part of our economy, guarantee something like that.
So why was the governor so unsuccessful in convincing lawmakers about his health care plan? Mark, what do you think happened there?
I think part of this goes back to the election. He came out of that election very weak, not a lot of oomph, not carrying a lot of truck. I don't really think the idea would have passed anyway, but it really had no chance when he came in there kind of almost limping into the session. What people were very concerned about this, it sounded very small, but there's just a real distrust of government that once you give them the power and opening up a payroll tax, the fear was that it would just go up and up and up by incremental amounts.
Pete, do you think if the governor had used a different revenue source that the outcome might have been different?
I don't. And here's why. House and Senate lawmakers considered just about every tax, fee, and assessment under the sun to raise the $90 million that Peter Shulman wanted to generate with the payroll tax, and they came up empty. They hated the idea of the payroll tax, but they all really liked the idea of addressing the Medicaid cost shift, which is viewed as this structural deficiency in a healthcare system that's jacking up rates on private insurers. It's an inefficient and non-transparent way to deal with healthcare costs. The problem is that fixing the problem is incredibly expensive. You've got to raise a lot of money, and bad reimbursement rates and all the negative things that happen as a result of them are the devil that the legislature knows. Raising $90 million in new revenues is the devil they don't, and they're just still not ready to get themselves acquainted with that right now.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the people and issues of the 2015 legislative session. What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you think were some of the most important issues of the session? Are you pleased with the way that lawmakers dealt with those issues? We've been talking about the Medicaid cost shift. In the end, lawmakers did very little to reduce the Medicaid cost shift. Was that the right decision? And do you think the education restructuring bill will actually reduce property tax burdens in the short term or the long term? 1-800-639-2211 if you'd like to give us a call. Terry, as we know, back in December, the governor abandoned his plan to have Vermont implement a single-payer health care system. Do you think that decision spilled over into the health care debate during the session?
Well, yeah, of course. And I think there was just a total mistrust of anything he had to do that had anything to do with health care. And a lot of that stemmed from Vermont Health Connect and the problems that went on with it and still go on with it. And I just think there was a real intolerance for doing anything healthcare related, and that helped spell the doom of his $90 million package. And they already were raising $30, $35 million in revenue for the just to run state government. So the idea of raising a lot more money for healthcare at a time when this other healthcare thing doesn't even work right just wasn't going over very well.
And with the demise of the governor's payroll tax plan, as Terry mentioned, lawmakers worked to find some other options to help fund the budget. We heard discussions about a sugar-sweetened beverage tax, changes to income tax deductions, expanding the sales tax. So, Pete, how did this all come together at the end of the session?
As it relates to health care, it didn't really come together at all. They ended up with a $3.2 million healthcare quote reform bill that really just gets enough expenditures to almost maintain the status quo. There's some minor Medicaid reimbursements for primary care doctors. They couldn't find any revenue mechanism that the negative effects of which offset the benefits that they were going to get from increasing Medicaid reimbursement rates. Shab Smith, from the beginning, said, if we're going to go at this, we got to go at it in a big way that's going to make people notice, or we're not going to do it at all. And when it became clear that they weren't going to be able to raise $90 million or even $60 million or $40 million, they said, look, let's not expend a bunch of political capital. make a bunch of people angry, risk whatever economic damage is going to come about as a result of these tax increases if we aren't even going to be able to raise enough to show the public a difference in the way the system is going to work.
We did get this email about the Medicaid cost shift. Does anyone think that Medicaid cost shift problems can be resolved next year? I think it's an important issue, not so much because of medical costs, because people on Medicaid have trouble finding medical care. Many doctors won't take patients who are on Medicaid. I saw the impact of that when I was at the state psychiatric hospital. A lot of admissions could have been avoided if people had had access to good health care. Mark, we got another 20,000 people have been added to the Medicaid program. Is this an issue that comes back next year?
Well, I think there will probably be an effort to do so, but I don't know where the revenue comes from. I think the real concern on the part of people in Montpelier is that they're leaving all this money on the table, that the feds could be matching this almost one for one, and that, you know, that won't happen unless you draw it down some way. Yeah, I think they're going to try to keep finding a way to fund this. But, you know, again, it's next year is going to be another budget challenge year. Good luck.
There also was a pretty good fight between the governor and legislative leaders at the end of the session on the issue of eliminating some income tax deductions. Here's the governor describing his opposition to any changes.
I feel very strongly that it would be a mistake to remove the charitable deduction, the home mortgage deduction, and the catastrophic health care deduction. I think it will hurt Vermont. And my job as governor is to make sure that we do things that help Vermont, not hurt Vermont.
But House Speaker Shap Smith said it was important to use some of these deductions.
I think there's going to have to be some component within the revenue package that will be progressive taxation.
So, Terry, in the end, is this a case where both sides had to give a little bit?
Yes, and I think the governor gave more in the sense that he drew the line of we're not going to do income tax deductions, and then in the end they did. But, yeah, all of the other taxes that they were raising, the sales tax on soda, cigarette tax to pay for health care, are more regressive taxes. And this was one attempt to get at potentially something more progressive.
I got to say, I don't really think the governor gave up that much at the end there. To get the carve out for medical expenses, to get the carve out and to not count charitable deductions, really only left for him the mortgage deduction. And you have to have a really significant mortgage with a lot of interest in order to really hit that cap. I have to say, I was really struck the last couple of weeks that he was almost trying to channel Howard Dean and doing this crusade against the legislature. At one point, he was describing how he and other Vermonters sitting around the dinner table and looking back at the legislature at all these taxes they were raising. And he had, you know, proposed more, as much, if not more, at the beginning of the session. So, you know, I really think at the end it was really mischaracterized. I think he should have claimed victory on that and gone home.
There's an interesting spreadsheet to look at, and it shows the difference between the legislative tax proposal, the administration's original tax proposal, and what they ended up with in the end. And noteworthy is the effect on the top income earners in this state, the very few people that are making $1 million a year or more. The governor's original plan would have resulted in, and I think on average, about a $400 or $500 increase per year on them. Lawmakers' plan would have resulted in a close to $20,000 per year on average increase for those high earners. They ended up with something that will raise about $5,000 a year on average more from those very rich people in the state. It's closer to what the governor had at the beginning than what lawmakers were looking at, but still a pretty significant increase from what they were considering at the outset.
Terry, early in the session, backers of the sugar-sweetened beverage tax had a lot of optimism that this would be the year for their plan because lawmakers needed money. They had a plan that could raise somewhere between $25 and $35 million. Why was their plan so unsuccessful?
Well, there is a country store in every town in Vermont and a country store owner, and all of those people got tapped to argue against the tax. And then the Beverage Association spent a lot of money lobbying against this. It hits people where they live, and it ends up generating a pretty loud cry. But yeah, going into the session, there were a lot of legislators with some power who really wanted this, and it did seem like it was going to have some more legs than it had. And I think that was a real example of what Peter was saying at the beginning of, like, they did not know where this was headed, and they kept trying, and it spent a long time between committees, among committees in the House, and ended up falling apart.
Now, Pete, in his post-session interviews, the governor says he's very pleased that the budget's been balanced, and it's been balanced without needing to raise taxes. This is how he describes it.
To come up with a sensible revenue package to help put Vermont on a fiscally strong foundation to the future. The fact that we did this without raising income tax rates, sales tax rates.
Now, there's the key phrase, rates, mm-hmm. because we certainly talked about income tax deductions being changed and also the sales tax being applied to soft drinks. So is that a fine distinction that the governor is making?
I'd call it some awkward verbal gymnastics. He and the legislature raised income taxes. They raised sales taxes. And Vermonters, I think, understand that government has levers other than rates that it can use to generate additional revenue. If you're upset about the fact that government is going to be raising your income taxes or raising your sales taxes, I don't think caveats about not touching rates is going to make them feel any better about it. In his public statements during the last few days of the session, Shep Smith acknowledged these tax increases in a much more direct way. And he said, hey, we're raising your taxes. I don't like it, but we're doing it. And we're going to try to do it in a way that makes the burden fall disproportionately on the wealthy, because we think we've made some reductions to government programs that are going to hurt poor folks. And so it's only fair if we try to get some extra money from rich folks. And it'll be interesting to see if Peter Shumlin heads out onto the trail this summer, continuing with this message that they somehow didn't raise any broad-based taxes because they left rates alone.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the people and issues of the legislative session. What are your thoughts about this session? We'd love to hear from you today. 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about different taxes that were raised, the Medicaid cost shift, which was not really addressed, other issues coming up in just a moment. We're going to talk about the education restructuring bill, also the Lake Champlain cleanup bill. Your thoughts about this session? Was it a good session, a productive session? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, a reporter's roundtable looking at the people and issues of the legislative session. With us today, Terry Hallenbeck, who covers politics for 7 days. VPR's Pete Hirschfeld and Mark Johnson, the host of The Mark Johnson Show on WDEV. What are your thoughts about the session? 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps there are some bills that you care about a lot. Did the legislature pass those bills? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Terry, when lawmakers arrived at the State House in January, there was all this talk about the need to address the rising burden of property taxes. Now, the legislature did pass an education restructuring bill that calls for larger school districts, but in the end, did they take steps to lower property tax burdens?
I think this probably did not live up to that hype of solving the property tax problem. I think they did have some caveats if they knew it was hard and it wouldn't necessarily be a 1-year solution. So they'll have that to fall back on. But the bill does have some constraints on education spending for the next couple of years, where high spending districts will be penalized if they spend over a certain amount, and low spending districts will have a little more room. And that's supposed to save some money, $12 million or so. But I think the education bill is pretty significant in the end, of just the way it nudges that debate along of finally we are going to see whether merging school districts will save money, because we really don't know. And we've been sitting here sucking our thumb over that issue for a really long time and think it at least moves it along a little.
Well, Washington Senator Ann Cummings is the chairwoman of the Senate Education Committee, and she said the goal of this bill is to deal with Vermont's declining student enrollment.
So we're trying to find a way, looking at the future with the continued declining enrollment, to help moving our schools now into a sustainable system for the future.
Bristol Representative Dave Sharp is chairman of the House Education Committee. He pushed hard to include a provision in the bill that Terry was talking about that would reduce costs in the short term. And this is how he described it.
It's a variable rate, and it's not a cap. What it is a high spending threshold. So communities can exceed these numbers, and they will pay more in taxes, and that additional payment in taxes will make the Ed Fund more robust and will reduce taxes across the board for all Vermonters.
So, Mark, how do you think local officials feel about this bill, and will it be successful in making more mergers in the future?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. You know, this is it's so difficult. People in Montpelier are so leery of trying to impose a solution from the state that I don't know whether or not at the end of this it really is going to make all that big a difference. Maybe it'll kind of nudge some people that would have already done it. But, you know, this consolidation is very difficult stuff. I think, you know, communities look at these schools as really their centers, and it's I think it's it may be like the lake bill and the water cleanup bill, where maybe it indicates a turning of the tide, but there's a long way to go before any sort of substantial savings are going to be made. And I would agree with Terry. I think there may have been way too high an expectation that was created for the public that there was somehow going to be a cut in taxes. There was no mood at all to change the formula. Because, as we know, every time you change the formula, you got to have a lot of extra money to dump it into it to make it work.
If that conventional wisdom is right, that in fact the message from the last election was that voters want prompt, significant action on reducing property tax rates, that could be a problem. This is not an overnight solution that the legislature has come up with here. The time that's going to have to elapse in order for some of these efficiencies and cost savings to result from these consolidated districts and potentially resulting in school closures we're talking about years here. The necessities of politics might run into the reality of policy if they don't get that short-term property tax relief that a lot of people are looking for, and it'll be interesting to see how Democrats handle that next year heading into a fall election if we don't see budgets coming in significantly lower than what people are hoping they are.
You know, it reminds me a little of the expectation people had in healthcare costs a few years back too, that somehow if we set up a Green Mountain Care Board, if you know we start this discussion about changing the system, that it's going to result in reduced costs. It's just not the reality.
Well, as Mark mentioned, lawmakers did support a plan to help clean up Lake Champlain and other waterways around the state, but there was disagreement over how to pay for it. Westminster Representative David Dean is the chairman of the House Water Resources Committee. He says he's pleased with the final version of the bill.
We're about to put some money out there on the ground to do projects to help municipalities, to help ag practitioners improve their impacts on the waters of the state. So I'm thrilled.
And at a recent press conference, the governor was asked if this bill is really going to make much difference in cleaning up pollution in Lake Champlain.
I think realistically no one can answer that question. We're going to learn as we go. But here's the good news. In the past, I think we have spent money on water cleanup without the knowledge that we have now. And what we know now is where the primary pollution sources are coming from, and we can actually rank them in terms of what we go after first, going after the largest challenges and moving back from there.
So, Terry, what do you think? Is this bill going to make a big difference, $12 million or so a year for the foreseeable future?
I think the significance is that farms may be finally put into more of a force you to clean up mode. But it does, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot of money for the size of the problem. And we shouldn't forget that they had to do this or the feds would have cracked down on them, and the feds could still crack down on them. So it's not it, – it probably moves things in the right direction, but I don't know that we can say it's going to be transformative.
And Mark, as Terry mentioned, the EPA is keeping an eye on this and the state is keeping an eye on the EPA because if they don't like this plan, they're going to impose their own.
Right. And they've been massaging the plan back and forth. The initial plan that the state put forward wasn't good enough in some of those critical spots. And so there, it's going to be, a work in progress on that. The other thing I think it's a little just bizarre about this, you know, Pete was mentioning at the beginning of the program how all these different funding proposals came up in a variety of different areas, the budget, healthcare. This one was just off the wall. I mean, it started with a tax on fertilizers. It winds up on a surcharge on the property transfer tax, which has nothing to do with cleaning up Lake Champlain, not really getting at trying to change some of those behaviors that have led to the pollution. And they've put themselves in a box now where they've got to come up with another funding proposal. And if you can't come up with one when you got the gun to your head of the EPA, how are they going to possibly do this down the road?
Let's go to our callers and talk to James in Middlebury. Hi, James. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm dismayed by the so-called water cleanup bill, the Lake Champlain water bill. It will not clean up the lake or make even any scratch on cleaning up the lake because the bill does not even mention the word phosphorus. It does not even mention the word nitrogen. It imposes no constraints on conventional dairy whatsoever, and conventional dairy is 50% of the problem. So the idea that we have somehow turned the corner or that we have somehow changed the dialogue is a ruse.
Terry, I know supporters of the bill would say there's some new best practices that would be used by farmers throughout the state. What about James's concerns, though?
I think he's got some points. Like, I think, you know, in the end, we always back off of being really tough, and I did sort of the same thing. Sometimes there's good reasons for that. You don't want to put farms out of business, but this may not be the solution that people are claiming.
You know, I think he also makes a fair point. For example, at the beginning, they were talking about putting a tax on fertilizer that's used by the agriculture community. This, you know, sort of all-in attitude that was being taken. And it seemed as though when they were talking about funding mechanisms that everybody wanted somebody else to be carrying the burden, whether it was the agriculture community pointing at the development community, maybe we should have tourists helping to pay for it. Everybody kind of wanted to do the least. It seemed as though they wanted to do the least amount of the responsibility they could possibly do.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the people and issues of the legislative session. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about the Medicaid cost shift, the Lake Champlain cleanup bill, the tax bill, the education restructuring bill. Was this a good session, or do you have some concerns? We'd love to get your comments or thoughts. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. And Pete, just following up on what Mark said, there was even a proposal at one point to place an assessment on every homeowner in the state of Vermont to pay for this bill.
And it had, frankly, surprising levels of support inside corners of the State House. This was a proposal that made it through two Senate committees before finally falling apart when it went to Senate Finance and Senate Appropriations. It would have been a $15 floor assessment on literally every property in the state, and then a sliding scale beyond that based on how much acreage you had. People felt like, hey, the runoff is coming from the land. We ought to tax the people that own the land to pay for reducing the amount of it that's going into our lakes. And this was met with very strident opposition from some powerful lawmakers, but also notably the governor, who said, look, let's call a spade. This is a property tax increase. It's only going to get bigger the longer it's in existence, and we can't add this new thing to people's lives.
That one's going to come back too. I mean, town clerks didn't like that idea for the obvious reasons, but this whole idea of having the burden spread to everybody so that this bill won't be just a Lake Champlain bill, it also include the rivers and they get everybody in on this. I think that one's going to get revisited.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Reg in Bennington. Hi, Reg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is regarding the healthcare system. I may not clearly understand it, but I thought that the legislature had passed a law, and we had, or still have perhaps, a law mandating that we move to a single payer or whatever term you want to use, but a statewide healthcare system, and that the governor unilaterally just said, yeah, that's the law, but I'm just going to ignore it, and we're not going to do it that way, and too bad. And it seems to me if we had the universal health care program, we wouldn't need to be talking about the Medicaid, Medicare cost shifts and who's going to, you know, people can't find a doctor because the doctors don't accept Medicare. If we had the universal health care, everybody would have a doctor, everybody would have health care, and the governor wouldn't be able to just unilaterally choose what laws he chooses to obey. Am I misunderstanding it?
Well, let's find out. Terry, my recollection is there were some triggers in that bill that said if any of these things aren't met, then the single-payer system would not go into effect. Do I have that right?
Right. They did not. Were not able to come up with the financing plan. And, you know, no, you can't bind a future legislature into, you know, action. So they can always, you know, not do it.
And it may seem, Reg, like this was a unilateral decision by the governor, and it appeared that way certainly when he made that dramatic announcement and the end of December saying he had decided to essentially pull the plug because he felt like it was going to cause that the financing proposal was going to cause undue harm on the Vermont economy. But I can assure you that there were an increasing number of legislators who had already come to the same conclusion without even having seen the financing proposal that the governor was going to put on the table. And there were a lot of people doubting whether or not even the best financing plan would have had a path through the State House.
You know, and this gets back to the healthcare exchange. I mean, the level of distrust because of how poorly that's performed really undermined any support that it had out in the public.
And we just got this email from Rabia in Norwich. I couldn't believe that Governor Shumlin put a $6 million cut in LIHEAP funding and the legislature approved the cut. There have been substantial cuts in what LIHEAP recipients receive every year for about the last 5 years. How does the crew in Montpelier think that low-income Vermonters will be able to heat their homes next winter? Mark, I think one of the justifications for reducing the funding for LIHEAP was that oil prices are down now, and so not as much money was needed. But is this sort of another problem that as soon as oil prices go back out, the legislature is going to have to deal with this again?
Yeah, and they'll probably come up with some money at that point. I mean, that seems to be the way it usually works with LIHEAP, that the amount of money floats up and down depending on what the price is, how cold it is. I mean, if it's as cold next winter as it was this winter, that might be a factor too. But it's one of those easy to grab funds that I think lower income people and their advocates are a little tired of it being, you know, one of the seemingly one of the first things that gets grabbed. But maybe the prices will stay low.
Today in the program, a reporter's roundtable looking at the people and issues of the session. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We've got a reporter's roundtable with Terry Hallenbeck, who covers politics for 7 days. Mark Johnson, the host of The Mark Johnson Show on WDEV, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Your thoughts about this session? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Well, maybe one of the surprise issues of the session was a bill to eliminate the philosophical exemption to the state's childhood immunization law. Terry, how did this emerge as a top issue in the final weeks of the session?
Well, the Senate squeezed it into a bill because it's something that they had tried to pass before and not succeeded in getting through the House. And that put it, you know, in the House's lap of they had to act on it one way or the other. And, you know, just saying no to it became not an option. You had – just saying no was having the debate also. So it ended up they decided, okay, we'll have the debate. So I think that was another one where people really did not know where that was going. And that just the day of it on the House floor, House leaders, you know, said we can't be sure how this one's going to play out. But they stripped out – you can no longer take a philosophical exemption to keep your kids from getting vaccinated. We only have the medical and religious exemptions.
You know, one of the things I – there was, of course, the outbreak in Oakland. But one of the other things I think may have been going on with this bill is that here's a legislature that's doing nothing but raising taxes and seemingly doing all these negative things. And I know that people who are not in favor of removing this exemption feel very strongly that it was the wrong thing to do. But I think for many legislators, they felt like, wow, here's something I did that's positive.
And the debate over this issue really intensified when Robert Kennedy Jr. came to the State House to oppose the bill. Kennedy argued that parents should be allowed to make this decision for their children because the Centers for Disease Control cannot be trusted to give people accurate information.
The regulatory agency that's supposed to protect us from the industry that it regulates has become the sock puppet of the industry that it's supposed to regulate. It is a classic captive agency. It's become a subsidiary of Big Pharma.
But Burlington Dr. Mia Hockett supported the bill and said a decision in 2012 not to address this issue has had a negative impact on the state.
By not removing the exemption, in essence, it was a validation that people on the other side, their fear-mongering, their pseudoscience, their misinformation campaign was valid. And so that perspective has been spreading and the exemptions have been increasing.
So, Pete, there are a lot of people who think, okay, the philosophical exemption is gone. There's still two more. One, the medical exemption, which you have to prove. Also, a religious exemption, which you just need to check off the box. So, in the end, is this going to make any difference?
Critics of what the legislature did this year say, no, it absolutely won't make a difference. And if your goal is to increase immunization rates in public schools, then there are far more effective ways to go about doing it. You already started to see in social media spheres people who have in the past invoked the philosophical exemption talking about perhaps finding religion and simply checking that box instead. But we will be able to track the impact that this legislation does have on immunization rates. The Department of Health keeps really refined statistics on that kind of thing. So in a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, we should be able to see whether there was any causal relationship between the move lawmakers made this year and vaccination rates in public schools.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Peggy in Craftsbury. Hi, Peggy. What's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you. I'd like to comment on the issue of health professionals or for their practices where Medicaid patients are being refused as patients. And Medicaid being a state financed program, at least in part, we have no business eliminating Medicaid clients as patients. That's just immoral. And I'd like to suggest that all health practitioners be required to have at least a minimum percentage of their practice be providing health care for Medicaid recipients.
You know, Peggy, what we hear from some of the independent physicians is that, you know, for some of their services, they're being reimbursed somewhere between 40 and 60% of their actual costs by Medicaid. So they say they've got to limit the number of Medicaid patients that they see. But are you saying at least all doctors should see a minimum percentage of Medicaid patients?
Yes, I'd like there to be some minimum percentage so that there is guaranteed coverage across the state for the Medicaid recipients.
You know, this is a great example of ways in which this problem is not just going to go away because legislators decided not to raise the $90 million and draw down the federal money and use it to increase Medicaid reimbursement rates. There were a lot of independent physicians who came into the statehouse over the course of the past few months and said, look, I'm a committed practitioner. I care about my patients. I feel like a horrible person when I can't take somebody who's on Medicaid. The fact of the matter is, if I do, I'm going to go out of business. Now, they didn't provide their books for us to look into, but they seemed like straight shooters. They seemed like compassionate people who had a real interest in helping lower income Vermonters get good medical care. And it'll be interesting to see the way in which this problem snowballs in the absence of any action and whether or not we start to see more providers say, look, we just can't afford to take these people anymore. And if the Medicaid insurance cards that government is giving to these folks suddenly aren't worth the paper they're printed on, or if we just start seeing them all pile into the emergency room because they can't find a doctor to treat them outside of one.
And they expanded what the eligibility is for Medicaid too, you know, on the federal level. So that's going to add to the numbers. And Vermont already had a very high percentage of the population on Medicaid. So it's only going to get worse. You're right on that, Pete.
Let's talk to Mo, who's calling from Rutland. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, the cost shift is a phase that's been repeated so many times, you would think it's true, but doctors can't cost shift. Blue Cross Blue Shield controls what doctors get paid. So if the doctor wants to charge $120 and Blue Cross Blue Shield pays $100, that's what they're going to take. The doctor can't shift it beyond what the insurance company is going to pay. So I don't think, you know, and I brought it up to Shap Smith when he was on the program. He couldn't really seem to answer it either. So show me where the cost shift is. Blue Cross Blue Shield controls the rate the doctors will be paid. That's the reality.
Here's how I understand it, and I don't claim any kind of in-depth knowledge of this, but when hospitals go to – and that's where the main cost shift is happening allegedly in our hospitals – when hospitals go to the Green Mountain Care Board and when private insurers go to the Green Mountain Care Board and they have to reconcile what hospitals are going to get for certain procedures and services versus what insurers like Blue Cross Blue Shield are going to pay for those, they look at what the revenues are and they look at what the expenses are. And when the revenues coming in from government insurance, i.e. Medicaid and Medicare, is a certain size, that means that everything else needs to be bigger or smaller as a result. Even a guy like Al Gobay, who has more power over this system than any other single person, says, look, if you get more money from Medicaid, then in theory that should allow us to reconfigure the equation in a way that lowers insurance rates for private insurers. I know there's a lot of skepticism out there about whether or not that's in fact the case, and you know, Mo lends voice to that.
Let's just quickly, in the time that we have left, looked at the way some individuals fared during this session. Let's start off with Governor Peter Shumlin. Mark, good session for him, not so good. How would you evaluate that?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to say anybody had a great session this year, given what, you know, Terry was talking about. This was kind of, you know, bad meatloaf. But, you know, I think for a guy who was pretty damaged by the election, he didn't come out as badly as I think many of us have portrayed. You know, he's still, you know, he's still in charge. He's still setting the agenda. He's still going to also have to deal with many of these problems that really weren't completely dealt with, like all of the state employee stuff. But, I think he's just politically in a very difficult situation. He didn't make any more friends this session on top of the, you know, the tough electoral vote that he had before.
Terry, what about Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott?
I think he had a chance to sort of step up in this session and didn't choose to. Like, he did not distinguish himself grandly. I don't think he walks away with as much baggage as the rest of them, because that's just not the lieutenant governor's role to set agendas and But he could have seized the moment more.
And finally, Pete, we got about 30 seconds. Do you think if we look at Peter Shumlin and Phil Scott, we're looking at least two of the gubernatorial candidates for 2016?
I will not venture a guess to answer that question. However, Peter Shumlin sounds very much like a man who is going to run for another term right now. Whether or not he wants everybody to think that so he retains the power that would come with being a candidate or not is unclear. And Phil Scott, it's there for the taking, a lot of people feel, and it'll be tough for him to turn down that opportunity.
Well, that's going to do it for our program today. Many thanks to our guests, Terry Hallenbeck, Mark Johnson, and Pete Hirschfeld. We really appreciate you being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
And now that we've heard the perspective of three State House reporters, tomorrow we'll get the governor's point of view. Governor Peter Shumlin will give us his take on the budget and many other issues. Send your questions or comments for Governor Shumlin to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Devin Karambulis. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.